This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A lot of people spend more time looking at a screen than they spend outside or even looking out a window. And this disconnect between humans and the rest of the natural world comes at a dangerous time as scientists warn of the effects of climate change. The new collection of nature writing from Appalachia aims to share the splendor of the region and provoke readers to think more deeply about the relationship between humans and their planet. Mountains Piled Upon Mountains, Appalachian Nature Writing in the Anthropocene, features contributions from writers from upstate New York to northern Georgia. Jessica Corey is editor of the collection. She also teaches in the English department at Western Carolina University and joins us from our partner station, Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Hello, Jessica.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Tell us why you decided to include writers from the entire Appalachian region in this collection. As we say, upstate New York all the way to northern Georgia.
Well, I notice that a lot of times the region gets characterized as sort of this monolith, and it's, you know, everyone's the same, and, you know, people, you know, a lot of times even think the topography is the same and things of that nature. And so one of the things that I wanted to try to do with this book is to show really how diverse the region is, you know, not only in sort of the topography, but in the environmental issues that are facing different parts of the region and in the writers themselves.
You have personal experience with that, being from Southeast Ohio and then finding yourself in Western North Carolina, right?
Yes, I do. I'm originally from Chillicothe, Ohio, so about an hour from West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky. And then I've been down in North Carolina for about 9 years now, and I've lived out in the mountains here twice. So I moved out here in 2012. You know, ended up back on the eastern side of the state for a while and then came back about 3 years ago. And I don't want to leave again.
So there's a great deal of variety in that place we call Appalachia. And yet there is some tie that binds, something that you felt deeply when you lived in Greenville for a while, right? Having lived in the mountains most of your life.
Yes. I lived in Greenville and I felt like a fish out of water. I mean, it was flat. It was hot. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I want to go hiking, and there's nowhere to go hiking, you know. So it was quite different, and I noticed that a lot of the things that I grew up doing, you know, rock climbing and hiking and being outdoors, you know, I had trouble doing in the flatlands just because there wasn't, you know, there weren't really hills and things of that nature. So, you know, it was nice to be back.
Yeah, and a culture around it. I mean, there can be trails. There's places mm-hmm. to walk, but when you have mountain streams and hills. That tends to be part of the culture. Getting out there and being on it is a big part of the thing. And also, in the first few pages of the book, you introduce the idea that every Appalachian writer is an environmentalist, right? Tell us more about that.
Yes, yeah, so that actually came from my colleague, Dr. Mae Miller Claxton, who she teaches Appalachian literature at Western. And we were discussing, you know, some of our favorite regional writers and Appalachian writers. And she said, you know, and I told her about a couple projects I was working on. She said, you know, every Appalachian writer really is an environmental writer. And I wanted to talk about that because one of the things that I noticed in a lot of Appalachian literature is that you know that it takes place in Appalachia, you know, because the environment actually is a theme. It's not just in the background. It's not just, oh, well, this is set here, but it could be taking place in Oklahoma for all we know because, you know, the only pictures we have are a lane and some trees and, you know. But in a lot of Appalachian literature, the setting is very much foregrounded. And it leads into a lot of other themes as well. You see a lot of Appalachian literature discussing, you know, mountaintop removal or mines or other things like that. So, you know, a lot of Appalachian writers really do put that in the forefront.
Well, I wonder about that, about the vulnerability of the Appalachian regions compared, because there are certainly other writers for whom place is a character. Mm-hmm. But if vulnerability of that place isn't the issue, then it simply becomes a better detailed backdrop. But what you're saying is you're always sent, the shadow of the threat is always, or in many cases, a part of the story.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, that might be a slightly terrifying way to put it, but yes, it definitely plays a role.
That's what I get paid for. Because if I didn't scare people a lot, they'd stop listening. You organized this by theme, which is interesting, not by region or not sort of geographically. Tell us about that.
Well, I initially thought about organizing it geographically. And the problem I ran into is that there were certain writers who, you know, just like myself, I mean, I'm from Ohio, but I'm writing from North Carolina. You know, there were people that, you know, had lived in the region and then moved away. For example, there's a Taylor Brown in here. You know, it was wrote this shortly before he moved to Washington State and was currently living in Greenville when he wrote about, you know, his childhood living in Western North Carolina. And so when I started to think about organizing it geographically, it became a problem because where do I put certain people, you know? Yeah. And I kind of ran that by the editor, and he said, well, then just don't do that. You know, find a different way to organize it. And, you know, so I started kind of looking at themes and read some other volumes, you know, for example, Colors of Nature and by Lawrence Savoy and a few other collections to see really how they were organizing it. And I thought, you know, like, we could look at themes here. And so I started looking at, you know, themes and sort of the tones of the pieces and did it that way instead. I think it turned out a lot better.
So tell us about the themes you came up with.
Well, we have, you know, sort of positive themes, like we're thinking about, you know, it ends on celebrate because I wanted to end on a high note.
So and nothing scary about this book. Folks, read this book. You will not be frightened. Go ahead.
You will not. There are sections called destroy. There is one of those, right. You know, and protect. There actually were two kind of scary sections, and then right. I just sort of put them together. But we do have a section on destroy, which talks about a lot of the environmental destruction that, you know, takes place in the region. And then there's a section on preservation, and not only preservation of the land, but also preservation of, you know, some of the cultural attributes that you might find in Appalachia. And then there's one on protecting and then evolving, you know, and that speaks to sort of the evolution of not only the people who live in the region, but the region itself. And, you know, we also have, it starts off with contemplation, since a lot of times, you know, we think of nature as a place to contemplate. So,
yeah, but the evolution is important too, because I think if you think one of the cultural attributes you might think of in association with Appalachia is kind of history, you know, sort of stuck in some kind of past. But that's not the case. And so I think, you know, pointing that out and making sure that writers are talking about that is a pretty important thing to do. You contributed a piece about farming and your family's connection, but I understand that you almost didn't have a piece in here. Tell us about how that all came about.
Yes. So I actually started this collection not knowing if I would contribute anything at all. I've always been a big fan of nature writing, and I kind of wanted to see a book that encompassed the whole region. So I started creating this book, but initially didn't have anything in it. And, you know, I'm trained as a poet, but I've also, you know, written some nonfiction and taken a couple courses in that. And one of the reader reviews from Chris Green, who is actually head of the Loyal Jones Appalachian Center up at Berea, he had a really wonderful review, but he said, you have a nature writing book with no mention of farming. And I thought, okay. And at this point, I hadn't decided if I was going to contribute. And the editor I was working with, Andrew Brzezanski's, who is now at University of Washington Press, I believe, he said, well, you know, what do you think you're going to contribute? And I thought, well, I could write a poem, but, you know, there's a lot of poetry in her already, and I don't necessarily want to add more to that. And so I thought, well, I guess I'll write something about farming since we need farming. And it just, this sort of piece just kind of, I started thinking about farming and my own personal experience with it. And this piece that's called Uprooted kind of came out of that.
Can you share a bit of that with us now?
Sure. My father's childhood and adolescence were spent in southeastern Ohio, running several family fruit stands, tomatoes, potatoes, green beans, berries. My grandfather had quite the green thumb, which ran in the family. His people, my people, I suppose, had settled in the area shortly after the Revolutionary War and farmed ever since. Then, when my dad was 13, his mother, tired of being a farmer's wife and with big dreams of striking it rich in the city, gathered her brood and moved an hour north. Like many Appalachians in the early 1960s and decades prior, she felt that working in a light bulb factory or plastics plant was far more of a reliable way to eke out a living than farming. Plus, she'd surely meet a man working in those places who'd provide her and the kids with a stable income. With no outlined visitation schedule or custody agreement, not to mention the distance and means to transport six kids, my dad never saw his father again until his sister encouraged him to pay his old man a visit, when dad was nearly 50. I imagine now that being kept apart for many years created a chasm of silence that seemed impossible to bridge. What Grandma may not have accounted for was that she was creating a chasm between her children and the land where their people labored as well.
That is Jessica Corey reading from a new collection, Mountains Piled Upon Mountains, Appalachian Nature Writing in the Anthropocene. She is the director and editor of the collection and my guest now on The State of Things. She's going to be reading at Blue Ridge Books in Waynesville this Saturday, August 10th at 3 o'clock. We'll talk about that chasm and how that's grown, not just in your family, but it seems to me it's one that is growing deeper for all Americans as we spend less and less time in nature. I mean, is this something that you think about?
I do, and I actually, later on in that piece, talk about how prevalent farming, you know, was in my grandfather's generation, you know, and then in my father's generation, and then, you know, in mine. And, I mean, it's just been such a steep decline, you know, and I don't, you know, I think we've all kind of noticed that, you know, in many places you see, you know, fewer farming operations, you know, or you see, you know, sort of giant agribusiness taking over. I think that that definitely is the case all over the place. I recently watched a documentary called Look and See, a Wendell Berry story, and they go into sort of the agribusiness, you know, that farming has turned into, and I think that that's certainly a problem all over the place.
Well, I'd like to bring in one of the contributors to the Mountains Piled Upon Mountains collection right now. Gene Hyde is an archivist at the University of North Carolina at Asheville. He's also there at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Gene, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks.
Good to have you here. Tell us about your piece, Shooting Rivers and Smoldering Churches, Fire and Rain in Southern Appalachia.
Well, it is an examination of the role of rainfall and fire, and it didn't start out to be that. It started out to be just looking at rain, but as the year 2016 rolled by and the wildfires hit, it became both about rain and fire.
Tell us about that evolution, where it started and why it changed. What were you thinking about initially, had there not been those other catastrophes that followed?
Well, I started writing it in the summer of 2016 because we were getting an unusual amount of rainfall, and it was also the centennial of the 1916 floods, which just sort of wiped out the Asheville area. The Swanano and French Broad rivers were inundated. And in that context, that historical context, I started thinking about, well, what's different about rain now? And started examining the nature of rainfall, what it meant to the mountains, how it was collected in the mountains. And then I set it aside for part of the summer. And then about November, when all of the wildfires hit and there was smoke wafting through the air in Asheville and your eyes stung, I started thinking about, well, there's drought too, and how does it tie into climate change? So it's a three-part essay, and the first part is looking at the rain, the second part looking at fire, and the final part ties it together some with some issues about climate change and hopefully a little bit of hope in there too.
Can you read for us a section of your contribution to this book?
Sure. The streams and rivers that flow through these hills ripple and rage with water that came from the Atlantic and the Gulf. Oceans which, in turn, are constantly being fed by the waters that flow from these mountains. As a collective drainage basin, the Appalachians are a critical component of the great water cycle. Through this aquatic catch-and-release system, the mountains disperse water in this part of the globe, and this ability to channel water on a planetary scale is part of the greater geological purpose of the Appalachians. As the eons marched on, this flow of water eventually eroded the Appalachians from tall alpine peaks resembling the Rocky Mountains to the heavily wooded drainage system we live in today. Unlike those upstart Rockies out west, the Appalachians are old folks when viewed through this geological lens, seemingly mellowed and long inhabited by a dazzling mixture of flora and fauna, with humans being the most recent visitors to the scene.
On The State of Things today, Gene Hyde, University Archivist for UNC Asheville. He's reading from the new collection, Mountains Piled Upon Mountains, Appalachian Nature Writing in the Anthropocene. He's my guest along with the editor, Jessica Corey, and she's going to be reading at Blue Ridge Books in Waynesville this Saturday, August 10th. Gene, you include epigraphs from writer Fred Chappell. How does he influence your work?
Well, I was reading Fred Chappell's Midquest, a truly brilliant poem cycle, when I was starting to write this, and realized that he had been talking about similar issues about flooding, and he was also talking about fire. There's a poem there where his grandfather's church burns. And those seemed to be extremely telling as I was trying to craft this narrative. So I'd put them in at the beginning of each one. And then the rain metaphor that he works with the flooding of the French Broad, comes back at the very end, because the protagonist in that poem, Virgil Campbell, actually takes his .22 rifle out and starts trying to pick off the bridge that's being inundated by the flood.
It's, you know, when you think about people who live out in the environment and for whom the environment is definitely integrated and part of their lives, change is a part of everybody's. They understand that mountains are created and move and shift, and sometimes there's a lot of rain and sometimes there isn't. But talk about the power now of writing about these kinds of environmental changes that are happening so rapidly in what is a really much different environment than the simple change that we, that people who make a living outdoors have noticed before. The importance of writers paying attention to this. Gene, I'll ask you the question first.
Well, I think it's really critical that writers observe what's going on and try to channel it through their own creative impulses and motivations and influences. And I think this book is a really great example of how a wide range of voices can kind of contribute to a larger whole. You know, nature writers have always been important. You can make the argument that if it wasn't for John Muir, we wouldn't have the national park system now.
Mm. Well, A Silent Spring also helped to bring our attention to to this kind of thing. What about, Jessica, you? Let me ask you the question, the role of nature writing as we grapple with climate change.
Well, I would agree with Jean in that I think it's absolutely essential that we do have nature writers grappling with climate change, you know, especially now that we're seeing it so often. You know, as he was noticing, you know, we went from flooding and then now we have wildfires and, you know, and we have more wildfires. And so I think that, you know, the more that people are noticing it and observing it, you know, the more we're able to tell more people about it and, you know, possibly create change. I mean, you mentioned Silent Spring, and that's a great example. You know, is were people noticing that? Yes. But that book really kind of served as a catalyst to, you know, kind of start, you know, changes that would be more beneficial for the environment.
But here's where I might start getting a little scary again. That book came out at a time when, you know, people felt connected and there weren't quite as many distractions about our connection with the natural world. I'm wondering, in a world in which so much comes to us in mediated form, where so much of our experience now is mediated, if it can have writing or any other form of communication can have the impact, are we species? Are we becoming a species that just doesn't care?
Well, and I teach mostly freshman students, and so I definitely see students who sometimes have a disconnect, you know, from books and from sort of traditional forms of writing. But the thing to notice is that, you know, I see a lot of hope in those students as well. And a lot of them are very much connected to the outdoors. In fact, I'm teaching a class that's part of a learning community that's an outdoor adventure-focused learning community. And a lot of students are actually concerned about climate change. In a class of 20, I have probably at least a third of them writing about, you know, the destruction of, you know, the world due to climate change pretty much every semester, and that's just in one class. So I think that people, even if they're not, you know, reading, you know, traditional books or out in the world every, you know, or they're surrounded by media and things, they're still paying attention to that. You know, I mean, we all notice when it gets hotter out or when there are wildfires or when there's flooding and things like that. So I think that there is a good bit of hope.
It's the distraction. I mean, obviously, reading is a mediated experience. And if you're reading a book, you're not walking in the woods, or maybe you can do both. I don't know. But, Gene, you know, there weren't as many distractions. And I wonder, there are ways in which we can make ourselves feel like we're out in the woods that we couldn't do a long time ago. And if that's a worry to you, or if you think maybe the big question is the impact, if you think this kind of writing can have an impact, Gene.
Well, I think it can, and I think that the more awareness people have about what's outside their window, and the more eloquently it is told to them and they seek out that kind of thing, that they're more likely to get out in the woods and they're more likely to go out past their yard. Kind of echoing a little bit what Jessica was saying, I see a lot of students coming in special collections at UNC Asheville, and there are a whole lot of people that are here because of the outdoors. They want to do their papers on outdoor projects. They want to work with collections about the Carolina Mountain Club or other outdoor things. So there's It's very much important to a lot of the people that we see coming in as first and second year students at UNC Asheville.
Good stuff. Gene Hyde, contributor to the collection, which is known as Mountains Piled Upon Mountains, Appalachian Nature Writing in the Anthropocene. Jessica Corey is the editor, also teaches at the English Department at Western Carolina University. Gene is a contributor to the collection, and he is at Blue Ridge Public Radio at the moment as well. Jessica is going to be at Blue Ridge Books in Waynesville Saturday, August 10th at 3 o'clock, and we've got the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Jessica and Gene, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, a new audio documentary that captures stories of African-American farmers and fishers. Stay tuned.